Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Good day. Welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today I'm pleased and honored to have with us Dilip Hero. Mr. Hero is a well-known journalist and author based in London, and today we are speaking about his newest book, Cold War in the Islamic World, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and the Struggle for Supremacy. Welcome, Mr. Hero.
Thank you.
Mr. Hero, what is the thesis of your book?
I think basically what I'm talking about, you know, is a competition between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the Islamic Republic of Iran to show that they are the leaders of the Islamic world. You know, I mean, you can't have two leaders. You know, as you know, In a forest, there can only be one lion. If there are two lions, they will fight each other. So this competition got going once there was Islamic Revolution in Iran, and it became Islamic Republic. So basically, we are talking about conflict between a monarchy, which is an authoritarian monarchy, as in Saudi Arabia, and Islamic Republic, as in Iran. So that's a basic conflict.
You commence the book with a description of what you refer to as a, quote, soft coup, unquote, which saw Prince Mohammed bin Salman leapfrog over his cousin to become the heir apparent to the Saudi throne. Why did you commence the book in that fashion?
I think basically, you know, Charles, in any book or anything, a good newspaper article, you have to open your thing with a strong opening, you know, to engage the reader. Now, the thing about Saudi Arabia is that, you know, it didn't make much news. Of course, some king died, some, you know, maybe they raised the price of oil. But in the 3 years when Salman bin Abdulaziz became the ruler in January 2015. In 3 years, he has made more headlines, international headlines, than the kingdom of the past 30 years, because he has made so many changes so quickly. And you see that everything is very hierarchical, you know, in the kingdom, you know, and seniority of age and so on and so forth. But in this case, Salman changed the rules so fast, so quickly, that, you know, you were left in a dizzying, your head was dizzying, going, you know. So within 3 years, what he did, first thing was that the earlier crown prince, which had been fixed before, that's bin Nayef, that's Mohammed bin Nayef, he was 56 years old, he was kicked out, and Salman promoted his son, who was only 31 at that time, to become the crown prince. So I think that really is a very big news. You know, it's like earthquake, you know, when all the furniture or buildings are rearranged, that's what happened. Not only that, he kicked out elbowed out the previous Crown Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, MBN. But then that former Crown Prince went back to his palace in Jeddah. All his previous guards were changed completely, and his bank accounts were frozen. So it wasn't simply moving one and putting somebody else, but they really completely changed the whole thing. And that really such a big news that I had to put it up front to, of course, you know, engage the, you know, it's quite honestly, if we all know that this it's a throne, you know, the TV series, you know, constant changes happening. That's why I started the book in that fashion.
Can you describe the origins of the rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran?
I think rivalry is essentially between, you know, being a republic. So you can, of course, the Islamic Republic of Iran is by no means a liberal democracy. But the fact is that every 4 years, they have a parliamentary election, they have a presidential election, and, you know, and presidents have changed. You know, there are 3 or 4 different presidents have come. Some of them moderate, other radical hardline. So the fact that the last Hassan Rouhani, who, you know, the one who is now there, and he was there before, nobody expected him to win 57% of the vote in the first run, and he got that. So that means democracy. In democracy, if you don't know who's going to win, that is the final test of democracy. Now, in terms of what happens in Saudi Arabia, of course, I explained this before, there's no such a thing like who will be next, or what will be next is decided by one person. And that is it. There's nothing else that you can do. Now, if you are looking at something, shall I say, more interesting or more newsy, now, at one point, November 19, 2017, King Salman overnight wrote a decree. He appointed anti-corruption committee. He appointed his son as a chair of that. Within 24 hours, up to 300 people arrested and put in jail. You know, the jail happened to be a very five-star hotel. So I'm trying to show the difference between the governance of Iran and the governance of Saudi Arabia.
You take a what we call essentialist view of this rivalry or competition. And by essentialist, I'll give you a description. At my club about 2 years ago, there was an Israeli speaker who was not an academic, but he used to be in Israeli intelligence. And his description of the rivalry between these two countries was that this was something going back to the 7th century AD. So that's what I mean by essentialist. Do you take an essentialist view of this competition?
No, but just to see what's happening is, you know, again, as you know, ultimately one has to look at the what's called the baseline or the basics, the fundamentals. The point is that the Saudi regime has been put on the defensive because there's no parliament, there's no consultation with citizens, you know, what they should do or should not do. Something happens overnight. You see, there's no input of the citizens into the governance of a country. And that has put them on the defensive, you see. And on the other side, of course, as I explained, everybody knows there have been so many elections since the revolution in 1979 in Iran. And even a sweeping leader is not just for life. Every 8 years, he has to be confirmed by a popularly elected assembly of experts. So this is they are on the defensive, and they, meaning the Saudi royals, have found a way of diverting it by saying, what's in Iran is a Shia Iran, is a Shia Islam. We are Sunnis. Now, worldwide, Sunnis are 85% of the population, and the Shias or Shiites are about 15% of the population. So that is something they harp on. That doesn't mean the Saudi regime says, oh, they are Shias. They have nothing to do with us. We are Sunnis. And that's what they are trying to do. But ultimately, it is their own defensive posture. And, even just something else quite interesting. At some point, something called the Shura Council, Shura means Advisory Council, was set up in Saudi Arabia. They had 60 members, then they went up to 120. Then even, all of them nominated, And then the King Abdullah appointed 30 women, and so the 150 members strong Shura Council, or Advisory Council. You would think that this young crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, he's talking about reform, 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 that you would hear something more about an advisory council. Because advisory council itself, by the stroke of the pen of the king, can be given more powers. But they have no powers. They simply meet sometime, and even whatever they say does not get into the local press and so on. So I think that is a basic point. Of course, Bin Salman, or Mohammed Bin Salman, is very much aware of what you may call the public relations, PR. Women can't drive, so they're very big news in the Western world. So he says, okay, they can drive. So that is it. But the key point is that in Saudi Arabia, adult women are treated as minors. They cannot travel on their own. They cannot have a job. They have to get permission from their guardian, who could be even a younger brother, has to be a male. So that is the key point. What's called a guardianship rule is the key point about keeping women as minors, as third-class citizens. That's the key point, and that's not being talked about.
Would it be accurate to say that prior to the fall of the Shah of Iran in 1979, that this rivalry was, for all intents and purposes, non-existent, or at the very least, extremely muted?
Now, that's quite true. You see, what happened, this was a proper revolution in Iran. And again, one has to say, whether you like it or not, it was quite a unique phenomenon, because it was a religious revolution. All revolutions before, starting within Mexico, the Bolshevik Revolution, the French Revolution, they were all secular revolutions. This was Islamic revolution. Now, why it happened? Because the Shah, the Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi, he was the ruler, but he was under the 1907 constitution. And in that constitution, it clearly says that the ruler of Iran will protect Shia Islam, etc., etc. But the Shah of Iran basically ran a secular regime. And of course, he was very much on the side with America. So he was on the side of America for his own reasons, because his country had common borders with the Soviet Union. And so his friendship was very much appreciated by Washington, because it's next door to the Soviet Union. And then on the other side, of course, from February 1943, when U.S. President Roosevelt, Franklin D. Roosevelt, he wrote executive order in which he said the defense of Saudi Arabia is the defense of United States. Since then, that basically America has been a protector of Saudi Arabia, and every president since then has endorsed that statement made by President Franklin Roosevelt, you see. So in that sense, here is basically, if one is looking for one-liner, here is one-liner. America, which is the protector of Saudi Arabia, is a great Satan for the Iranian regime. And that basically shows you the contradiction. There is a deep hostility between the two sides.
Who would you say was the primary culprit in the commencement of the Iran-Iraq War in 1980.
Yeah, that's true. See, again, one has to look at certain things in a larger concept. Whenever there's a revolution, a genuine revolution, like in the Bolshevik Revolution in the Soviet Union, then that revolution tries to spread it in all the countries surrounding that country where revolution has taken place. The rulers of the countries surrounding them, they are very much afraid that revolution will spread. You know, because, you know, you can see what happened next door, and so the people will come up. And of course, in the case of, say, the Bolshevik Revolution 1917, countries surrounding them were all monarchies and aristocratic regimes. So they were very much afraid. So what happens is that revolutionary regime then tries to export its own model as a defensive means, you know, so that, you know, so that they don't get crushed, you know, because after every revolution, attempt is made for counter-revolution. And if you are, you don't have to look very far, look at Arab Spring 2011, then the counter-revolution. Everything has gone back except in Tunisia. So that's basically what happened in Iran as well. See, so now, Khomeini, who of course is a Shia leader, and he was expelled by the Shah in 1963. Then he was living in the holy city of Najaf in Iraq, because that's a place of the Shia learning. And so when he became himself the founder of the Islamic Republic, he encouraged the Shias, Shiites in Iraq, to rise up against Saddam Hussein. The very quick history of Iraq is that for a long time, Iraq used to be one way or the other, either with Ottoman Turks, who were Sunni, or with the Safavids in the Persian Empire, who were Shia. So Iraq being on the border, once on one side and the other side, in 1638, finally, what we know of Iraq was incorporated into the Turkish Empire, Ottoman Turkish Empire. And because they were Sunni, therefore Sunnis ran the country of Iraq from 1638. And so, but Shiites in Iraq are 60%, 60. So Khomeini tried to encourage the Shiites in Iraq rise up against the secular regime of Saddam Hussein, who was Sunni. That failed. And of course, and there was a row between the two sides, and it went on for 8 years. And very interesting to see, when that war was going on, very few Shiite soldiers defected to the Iranian side. You're so powerful propaganda machine by Saddam Hussein regime, and the nationalists, and the Arabs, and these Persians, and so on, that very few defected to the other side. So in that sense, Khomeini's attempt to overthrow the regime of Sunni Saddam Hussein failed, and for eight years, nothing changed. See? But now, of course, things changed after 2003, and we can talk about that.
Why did the continuing on the war for a second? Why did the Iraqi forces perform so poorly at the beginning of the war?
I think what happened was, you see, actually, I was in Iran after the revolution, not during the revolution, but you wouldn't believe at the time of the revolution, before the revolution, Shah of Iran had 440,000. Troops in his military. And when the revolution happened, even in Tehran, there was not a single soldier. See, all the soldiers, they either defected, they threw away their uniforms, and so on and so on. So basically, the army was destroyed. You know, I mean, it disbanded. Then, of course, the new regime tried to recruit people, and so on and so forth. So in that period, from February 1979, until September 1980, when the war happened in Iran-Iraq, Iran was in a very weak position. See, their army had disbanded, because all their weapons were mostly from America, and they had batteries with America. America would not supply them with spare parts and so on and so forth. That's one. Secondly, those generals who were with the Shah, when Khomeini came to power, they actually went over to Baghdad in Iraq, and they sided with Saddam Hussein, and Saddam Hussein gave them their radio station and so on and so forth, and they encouraged Saddam Hussein to say, Khomeini is very weak. If you just go this way, then people rise up and he'll be finished. And that was why he was encouraged by former Iranian generals for their own reason. Then, of course, because Khomeini was attacking the regimes of the monarchs in the Gulf, that monarchy is un-Islamic, so they encouraged Saddam Hussein also to attack Iran. And, of course, he himself was very much afraid that if the Shiites were a majority, if they rise up against him, then his regime will be threatened. So they were, and of course, America also encouraged him. So all these things came together to encourage Saddam Hussein to invade Iran in September 1980. But things did not turn out that way, because when this happened, then Iranians were very nationalist. See, Iran has a long history going back 6,000 years. And Iranian identity is very strong. And they, even those who were secular Iranians who did not like Khomeini, who did not like Islamic regime, they signed up to fight as Iranians against the Iraqi invaders. And that's why the war went on for a long time. And essentially, again, just a headline, the unintended consequence of Saddam Hussein's invasion of Iran was to help Khomeini consolidate the revolution. Unintended consequence, that's what happened.
Why did the current supreme leader in Iran succeed Ayatollah Khomeini in 1989? He was by no means the most senior cleric who could have done so.
Now, that's true. I see, again, when I have to say this, that the Islamic model of governance in Iran is very special. This is a Shiite model, of course. And what they are doing, and again, I have to be very brief and in a broad line. You see, the Shias, Shiites in Iran, they believe there were 12 imams. Imam means the supreme leader in a long time before. And the last imam disappeared. Actually, what happened was that he was a small baby. Floods came and his body could not be found. So the Shiites in Iran, who were called Trailer Shiites, they believe that this disappeared imam will come back and we are fighting for him to come back and so on. So in the meantime, we have to have some other leader. And so, for instance, Khomeini, he was a leader. He was a leader for life. But that is only for him, it was for life. But the constitution of Iran, which says that we have to have a supreme leader who has to be elected for every 8 years by an assembly of experts. Experts meaning those who are experts in Islam. You might say mullahs. And they are directly elected. So every 8 years they elect, or in the case of Ayatollah Khamenei, he is a sitting supreme leader, so they confirm him to go on for 8 years. But the 8 year thing is not for life, you see. So that is a very special way of doing certain things. One other thing that I must say, anybody who bothers to read the Constitution of Islamic Republic of Iran, which you can get on online, you will see in the preface they say that we are going for democracy because in the Quran, we quote the Quran. In the Quran it says, consult them, consult the believers in their affairs. So what we are doing is in the name of the Quran, not because of Greek democracy. We are not doing that. We are doing according to what the the word of Allah, the Quran says, consult them, the believers, in their affairs. And that's where the Iranian government would point his finger at the Saudi regime and say, how are you consulting your believers? Are you consulting and how are you doing it? That's the key point.
Why did the detente between Riyadh and Tehran in the mid to late 1990s come to nothing substantively?
The counter-revolution in Iran.
I'm sorry.
Yes, of course. Attempts were made to overthrow the regime. You see, that always happens. You know, I mean, it's a given. When you make a revolution, then those who are displaced from power, they may be a small minority, they may be a large minority, it doesn't matter, they will try to come back, and they use all kinds of means to come back. And attempts, repeated attempts were made to overthrow the regime of Khomeini. And just give you one quick example. Soon after the revolution, they set up a party called Islamic Republican Party, and 74 member leaders of that party were meeting in one place, and bomb went off. 74 leaders of the ruling party were dead with one explosion. So, you know, and so you see, that means, you know, those who were against the regime, not only from outside in Iraq or something, inside the country itself, you know, there were forces working against the regime. They tried to topple it for various means, and that did not work out, because partly because, you know, the new regime later on tried to have a good intelligence, you know, and that's what happened. I mean, if one wants to look at much further, the last attempt that was made to overthrow the regime in Iran, you know, the American hostages were taken, and then attempt was made by the Carter administration to get them released. And the whole plan was made, and of course the helicopters went in to try and pick them up and so on. Now, for some reason, whatever happened, the helicopter broke down. It's a long story. And so what the regime in Tehran found, that all, you know, the missiles in around Tehran to hit down any flying aircraft, enemy aircraft, or all of those missiles had gone. They were not there. So this, they questioned the Air Force commander, their own Air Force commander. What happened? He said, "Oh, I sent them off to the north because ethnic Kurds are having rebellion." And it turned out that he was part of the plan of the CIA Carter administration plan to make sure that there are no missiles around Tehran to shoot down the helicopter which was going to come and pick up the American hostage, diplomats who were taken hostage. So I'm just giving you the basic thing. It was so deep. Various attempts were made, and that was the last big attempt, and that's it.
Yes, but in the book you do say that from the mid-1990s up to around year 2001, there was a relaxation of tensions between the two countries, or if you like, you refer to it as a détente. Why did nothing substantive or concrete come from that in terms of a more permanent relaxation of tensions?
Sorry, I'm sorry, what's the name of the president?
President who's the... No, I was saying that in the book, you state that...
Yeah,
Mid-1990s up to around year 2001, 2002, there was a relaxation of tensions, or if you like, a détente between Saudi Arabia and Iran. So, for example, in, I believe, 1997, 1998, there were trips made by Rafsanjani, as well as later Khatami to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Why did that relaxation of tensions in those years not result in something more substantive in terms of a better relationship between the two countries?
Yeah. I think, see, again, Charles, the main thing is here, when I say Cold War between in the Islamic world, I think once you look at the parallel with Cold War between the United States and Soviet Union, that Cold War was going on, but even in that Cold War, President Nixon and Brezhnev, a Soviet leader, they, you know, came to a certain agreement. You know, you remember they had a meeting in California, and you know, and they signed this ABM, Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, in 1972. See, so it isn't that, you know, the door is completely closed. See, so in the same way, between Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, and Saudi Arabia, there have been moments, there have been years when they had good relations. You know, because see, as long as Khomeini was there, Khomeini's word was law. You know, it was like a divine edict, so they couldn't go against him. Once he, when he died in 89, then things relaxed. You know, and so Rafsanjani became president, and he moderated the early foreign policy, and also economy was liberalized, and so on and so forth. So attempts were, genuine attempts were made on the both sides, you know, that they should come together. But then the two things did not come together, because see, ultimately we have to go back to this, that if Saudi Arabia is saying America is our protector, and they say America is a great threat, so when the relations, you know, there was a thaw between Abdullah, and in fact, there was the Islamic Conference Organization summit in 1997 in Tehran, you know, and that could not happen if the Saudis had not given the green signal. That happened, and the king of he was then crown prince. He went to Tehran. They had meetings, and they kissed each other's cheeks, and so on and so forth. So it just seemed to be fine. And then, at that point, King Abdullah, crown prince Abdullah, de facto leader of Saudi Arabia, said, "We'll be glad to help Iran and America, you know, settle their differences, and so on and so forth." And again, there. Moves were made, you know, when Bill Clinton was president in a letter in the second administration, you know, moves were made to, you know, bring about some thaw, in which, is, you know, there was an interview with the CNN that Iranian Christina Amanpour, and so in which the U.S. Iranian president said, you know, taking hostage was a wrong thing, for, should not have been done. And then on the other side, Secretary Mr. Albright said, you know, what the overthrow, the CIA attempt to overthrow the General Qaddafi regime of Mossadegh in Iran was wrong. So they were making steps to come together. That was to the very end of Bill Clinton's presidency. So then things completely change.
Would it be accurate to say that the Saudi fear of so-called Shia axis in the near Middle East really commenced with the fall of the Saddam Hussein regime in 2003, a regime, the Baathist regime, in essence being a Sunni regime?
Yeah. I will give my answer. You see, One of the basic points that I make in my book is that, yes, Iran's influence has extended to Iraq, to Syria, to Hezbollah in Lebanon, to Yemen with the Houthis. Now, the main point is, except for Syria, in all other cases, if Iran's influence has increased, it is because of the wrong or, shall I say, misguided policies of the USA and Israel. You know, now, take the invasion of Iraq by the USA under President Bush. Now, see, once Saddam Hussein was thrown out, and the power of the Sunnis was gone, and then one person, one vote was installed properly, anybody could see that when that happens, the Shiites, who are 60% of the population, they will get into the driving seat by the ballot. Anybody could have seen that. Now, if that had happened, and since majority Shiites are in power since after 2003, and they are Shiite, and many of their leaders took refuge in Iran during the days of Saddam Hussein. So naturally, they will be friendly with Iran. That is, you know, is taken for granted. So that's the thing in Iraq. Then we come to the Lebanon Hezbollah. I leave out Syria for the time being. Then you take Hezbollah in Lebanon. Now, there was no Hezbollah before 1982. In 1978, Israel attacked southern Lebanon and occupied it, and they were in occupation until 2000, despite the UN Security Council resolution to the contrary. And it was after that that the Iranian ambassador in Damascus in Syria, he helped few different Shia groups to come together and form Hezbollah. Hezbollah, by the way, means Party of God. And so that Hezbollah came into existence in 1982. So one can very logically argue Hezbollah is a creation of missed states or wrong states or aggression by Israel, whatever you want to say. They were not there before. That's one. Then we come to Yemen. In Yemen, one has to guess basics. Amongst the Shiites, there are three different subsects within Shiites, within Shias. Those who believe in 12 Imams, which is in Iran, in Iraq, in Lebanon. Those who believe in the five Imams, they are called Zaydi Shias, they are in Yemen. Then there are those who believe in seven, they are called Ismailis, a different ballgame. So because the five believers in Zaydi Shias who are in Yemen, they had no historical contact with the 12 Shias. There was no link between them before. See, because and in fact, if you look at the Islamic Republic's constitution, it says Article 12. Our official faith is Shia's 12 Imam, 12 Shias, but we also respect all the four schools of Sunni Islam, all the names are given, plus Zaydi Shias. So Zaydi Shias are separated out from them. Now, once Saudi Arabia got militarily involved in what was essentially a civil war in Yemen, then Iranians came to help the Houthis. Houthis are Zaydi Shias, and Houthi is the name of the leader. So they are Z-A-I-D-I, Zaydi Shias, and so they came to help them, and they have been helping them since then. So it isn't that Zaydi Shia Houthis were built up by Iran to upset the Saudis, the other way around. And it was on 25th of March, 2015, that Salman, that Mohammed bin Salman, who was at that time defense minister, he got involved. He attacked the Houthis in a very big way, and his idea was, the biggest strike, like just what you call awe and shock. And so the Houthis, who were in control of the capital city of Sana'a, they would run away. 4 years have gone by; they have not run away. So again, that is the main point. In every case, it is the missed steps taken by the Saudis or by the USA or by Israel. Then I come to Syria. Syria is a different ballgame. See, Syria, of course, again in Syria, majority population is Sunni, 70%, but the rulers are Alawi, who are part of the Shia Islam. And that is this minority ruling the majority. Okay? Now, when Islamic Revolution happened, the father of the present president, Bashar, his father, Hafiz al-Assad, he was the president, and he liked what happened in Iran, because he was very friendly with the Soviet Union. He was very left-wing, and he was, of course, Alawi, hyphen Shiite. So he very much liked the new regime in Tehran. His country, Syria, was the first country to recognize Khomeini's regime, Arab first Arab country recognizing. Since then, the relations have been very good. During Iran-Iraq war, Syria under Hafez Assad helped Iran in a big way because they had very good intelligence on Saddam's Iraq. So their relationship during Iran-Iraq 8-year war became very strong. And since then, Syria and Iran have signed mutual defense treaties and so on and so forth. And one of the treaties specifically said, we will help each other against foreign aggression and against internal disturbances, internal challenge to the regime. There are clear treaty signed in that fashion. So if the Iranians are actually in Syria, they are, according to those treaties, they have their soldiers, they are advising Assad, they have some of their troops fighting there, they are volunteers, and so on and so forth. So all of this, in a way, one is being very legalistic and illegally done, you see. So my basic point is, if Iran has extended its influence in the region because of missteps taken by USA, Saudi Arabia, Israel, and finally, of course, we look at Qatar. Qatar is a Sunni country. Qatar, the rulers actually are they belong to the same Wahhabi sect as the Saudis. But we know what happened. You know, it's just a really aggressive. The Crown Prince, put 13 conditions for the ruler of Qatar to immediately concede all those things within about 2 months. Otherwise, we will cut off relations with you. And that's what's happened. Now, because of that, actually, Qatar is closer to Iran than before. So I'm saying this is the basic thesis of my book.
Why was Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman so intent upon intervening militarily in Yemen? Was it an attempt at winning internal prestige in Saudi Arabia by winning what he erroneously thought would be a quick and easy victory?
No, that's true. I think, Yemen, to look at Yemen again, basically the Yemen was affected by the Arab Spring. And the ruler there, Saleh, Ali Abdullah Saleh, he had been in power since 1978. So because of the Arab Spring came there, so he had to step down. And then after him, his vice president, deputy president, he was elected or selected to become president. And so he, that is his successor, did not have full control of the army, so that's and he was not in such a strong position as Ali Abdullah Saleh, who had controlled the economy, he controlled the army and so on. And of course, you see, it's a tribal situation, and what you do if you are in power, you play one tribe against the other, you give some money or infrastructure projects to some and not to others, and that way you manage to stay in power. And there's very a strong image of Ali Abdullah Saleh. He said ruling Yemen is like dancing on the heads of snakes. So that he managed to do that. And once his position was he was removed from power, but he still was around. He still had his supporters within Yemen. And so his follower, he did not have the kind of support. And in all this, chaos, the Zaydi Shias, who are Houthis, who are in the northwest of Yemen, mountainous region, they used to have rebellions periodically against the city. Wants to come to the capital and take over the capital. And that was the main key point, and that could not be allowed by the Saudi regime to have these Shiite Houthis to be in charge of the capital. And of course, the successor to Ali Abdullah Saleh, he was actually allowed to escape so that they did not get in trouble, and he escaped. He went, he fled to Saudi Arabia, and so they said, oh, he is the proper ruler, and so we are going to intervene on his behalf. And interestingly, is this his name, he arrived on the 25th of March in Riyadh, and next day the bombing started. So all of this really was done in a way that, you know, that Saudi Arabia got involved without proper thinking, and Prince Mohammed bin Salman said it's all over in 6 months. No, it's 4 years have gone by.
Would it be correct to say that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman so far has proven himself to be, diplomatically speaking, maladroit and have a rather negative, unsuccessful track record?
Bin Salman having negative or what? I'm sorry.
Track record in terms of he's been primarily unsuccessful.
Yes, yes.
In his various in policies, at least in terms of diplomacy and foreign relations.
No, absolutely. I think if we just look at it, you know, closely, and of course I can very quickly give it background, you know, he is the eldest son of the six children born to King Salman by his last wife, who was 22 years younger than him. He's the eldest, you know, and he was born in, you know, at the time when, you know, the King Abdullah, he started to not send many princes to America for their education, and therefore Mohammed bin Salman did not go to America for education. He graduated from the university in Saudi Arabia, so his English was not very good, but even that university had a special section for foreign languages, and he picked up some English language there. So he was not fully informed about the outside world. You know, his view was very limited, you see. You know, and I'm not, and unlike his younger brother who went to Oxford and so on and so forth. So therefore, you know, his stepbrother, elder stepbrother, he went to Oxford, and so his viewpoint was very small, limited. You know, of course, he was the favorite son of King Salman for the reason, because I explained, his lost young wife, the eldest son, they really groomed him up, and so he gave him much power, and he was actually, his degree is in law. So he actually, when he became the defense minister, he became this as soon as Salman became the king, because Salman was defense minister before, and immediately what he did, interestingly, he beefed up the legal department in the defense ministry, because before that, the prince who was a sultan running it, he was very corrupt, he was getting his commissions and so forth. So he, Mohammed bin Salman, beefed up the legal side to make sure that look at old contract and the new contract should be properly done. And so he showed himself to be very aware and very dedicated, etc. So that really impressed his father. So he did it. So basically what he did, what he started to do, there was no opposition to him. There was no other person to disagree with him, or he could not have a debate with anybody. And he himself, because he appointed a couple of advisors who had Harvard education, and he, meaning Mohammed, MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, immediately tried to build up a public relations thing. And the first Western magazine he invited to interview him was The Economist. The Economist has a high reputation. Two-thirds of the Economist copies are sold in the USA, and, you know, and then Bloomberg's magazine, they put him on the front page. And so that way he gave himself a good exposure to the Western world, and that made him feel that he could do anything. Now, that is not the same as doing something in the region, because in the region there are certain forces which are very strong. And one thing that you have to learn, which is the basic thing about anything, before you engage with somebody who is your enemy or who is hostile to you, you must work out the maximum force that the enemy will bring up to fight you. That he never did. He has never done that. He said, Qatar, you know, will come attached to the great kingdom of Saudi Arabia. So if I say, do this, they have to do it. Boom. No, he doesn't understand. He doesn't understand that Qatar and Iran are sharing the world's largest gas field, you know, in the Persian Gulf. You know, and they cannot separate themselves because they are, you know, like Siamese twins. So how can you tell them, cut off trade relations with Iran? It's not done. So he doesn't go ahead and think what next, you know, and he just, you know, pushes hard, you know, and he thinks it will be done as if he's running the show at home. See, so he made a mistake. He made a mistake there. Then he went on about the Lebanon, because the Lebanese prime minister, he had a lot of contracts in Saudi Arabia, so he thought that he could handle him. He asked him to come and see him, and then he put him under house arrest. So he thought, now in your government, there are two ministers out of 30 who are Hezbollah. I want you to get rid of them. So the prime minister said, wait a minute, you know, it's not simply Hezbollah, two ministers. You see, Hezbollah's armed forces are as big as the proper army of Lebanon. So how do you expect me to just get rid of? There are only two ministers. He said, no, if you don't do it, he put him on a house arrest. So what I mean is that the basic thing that you have to understand, you know, going into Yemen, any defense correspondent of any newspaper could tell him or tell me or tell you, listen, if you are going to do a lot of bombing of your country, a foreign country or enemy country, then you must follow up the bombing with boots on the ground. Simple bombing is not enough. He never did that. He ruled out, I will not send Saudi soldiers, troops on the ground. He said, that's, no, I'll do the bombing and they will, so Houthis will leave Sana'a. So the basic thing, I mean, how can you be a defense minister of a country and basically the prime minister, the de facto ruler, go into a war not knowing the basics of war, not knowing the main thing? You go into war, you must know your exit. What is your exit point? When do you want to get out? He doesn't have that. He just went in, boom, we're going to do this bombing and these two. So I'm afraid all of these things he has done is totally wrong. They have been counterproductive, and anybody can see that if you were to sit down and give him, you know, mark him, you will give him minus E. Not minus D, you give him minus E. That's what it is.
Is there any possibility of another soft coup displacing or ousting him from his current position?
I think theoretically, King Salman can, you know, he has changed crown princes before, he could do the same with him. But that's simply not possible. Meaning, Mohammed bin Salman is in everything. He is in charge of running oil. He's in charge of, making sure that cinema is open. And you know, he is in every foreign policy, home policy, even getting rid of a very annoying journalist, Khashoggi, who was in America, to get him killed. He's in so many things that it's very difficult to see that Salman can actually say, okay, you're out, somebody else is in. That is simply not possible. Now, there have been some rumors that an attempt was made at the place where he lives. you know, by what do they call it, dissidents, you know, armed attempt was made to attack the place where he lives, and that attempt was failed, you know, because intelligence is very good. The other thing is that, you know, there could be an accident, you know, say he goes to the front and the Yemeni war to show how brave he is, and he may get blown up in a helicopter or whatever, that could happen. Or there could be assassination, because there was one assassination in 1975 of, you know, of King Faisal by one of his nephews. So that could happen. But I think his, you know, his intelligence is very, very strong, you know, and he never moves around without at least 30 security unit moving with him. Say when he came to America, the same thing. So I think that doesn't seem likely. The only thing is there may be some kind of accident, proper accident. Otherwise, you know, the main reason Western countries are not really getting, you know, harsh with him or is sidelining him, because he knows that he will be in power for the next 50 years. He's only 34 now, you know, and seeing what happened before, so he'll be there for a long time. Saudi Arabia is a very important part of the world economy, you know, and the whole strategic makeup. So they can't afford to sideline him.
Do Iranians view their foreign policy in the region in the same sectarian way that Riyadh does?
I'm sorry, what? I'm saying, I thought
Do Iranians view their regional policy in the same sectarian terms that Saudi Arabia does?
Yeah, I think, you see, the way things stand now, see, both sides are in a way locked in a particular position. And if one simply forgetting about what is one's bias and viewpoint, if you look at some of the statements that Mohammed bin Salman has been making, he has called Iran Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei the new Hitler. And then when he was in America, when I was interviewed, he said, you know, Hitler only wanted to capture Europe. Ali Khamenei, he wanted to capture the world. I mean, this is a, how can I say, absolutely silly statement. How can a Shia country, where Shias are themselves 15% of the Muslim population, how can leader of that country imagine ruling the world? So, you know, making these statements, and of course, I have to say, on the other side, the Supreme Leader of Iran has not engaged with him. He does not, you know, make a counter statement. He leaves it to somebody else if they have to, issue a rejoinder or something. So I think this is, given this kind of a state of affairs, I can't see that there will be some kind of a thaw or a compromise. You know, that's one thing. Second thing we want to remember, see, here is a contradiction. Bin Salman, that is, Mohammed bin Salman, he has huge plans to invest. You know, he's going to create a special super city which will be built with the help of $500 billion investment, and this will be run all by artificial intelligence, and there will be zero energy used by the fossil fuels and so on. This will require $500 billion investment. Now, his plan was to privatize the world's largest corporation, oil corporation, Saudi Aramco, and that will bring in money, hopefully $2,000 billion, and some of the money will go to build this particular city, and there are many other big projects. Now, how can you pursue that scenario of making all these big things and then get into a fight with Iran? The moment there is actual fighting between the two sides, all the people who have their money, they will, in Saudi Arabia, they will move the money out. Nobody's going to invest. So there's a basic contradiction. You know, this Mohammed bin Salman doesn't know which way to turn properly. Okay, you want to go for a big way, make up the economy, then concentrate on that. don't get into a fight with Iran, just let them do what they want to do. But he also wants to put down Iran, the Shia, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that way we have a major problem on hand with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman.
So do you envision, say, 5 or 10 years in the future that the rivalry will ameliorate somewhat?
You know, I'm sorry, John. Somehow I thought, because we're talking about, you know, future, I thought this might be the last question. I'm sorry, so I didn't hear your last question. I thought, if you tell me the last but one question, okay?
In essence, do you believe that the rivalry between the two countries will diminish, say, in between 5 or 10 years from now?
No, I think that, see, the relations between, you see, there's so much talk. Of course, we all know the policy of USA. You know, the USA policy, of course, Trump, President Trump is completely allied with Saudi Arabia, with bin Salman, Mohammed bin Salman, and of course he ignores the killing of Khashoggi, and you know, and of course even they are trying to meaning some companies in America are trying to bid for setting up civilian nuclear power plants in Saudi Arabia and so on. You know, USA is very much, or the Trump is very much allied with the Saudi Arabia, and because for them again, the demon is Iran. You know, and so they are trying to get Iran, but once again, they are pushing Iran, but they are, unfortunately, they are not working out the full strength of Iran. You know, Iran can draw not only within their own country, but all other countries around, which I said, you know, Syria, Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and Iraq, for example, is very much with Iran. It's not going to go away. You know, already the economies are very closely allied, you know, and I explained about Syria, and Syria, of course, is in deep economic trouble, so nobody, Iran doesn't have the money to reconstruct Syria, so that is not the major problem. But the key point, actually, so much of the, what shall I say, the initiative lies with Mohammed bin Salman, you know, whether he's going to pursue the economic dreams that he has about his country, or whether he's going to have very bad relations with Iran, which will, you know, make things much worse. And already there is what you may call triangular relationship between Qatar, Iran, and Turkey. Turkey is helping Qatar, because, you know, and as you know, it was in Istanbul that Khashoggi was killed, and it was President Erdogan who had been very much trying to, you know, have the world community interest into the killing of Khashoggi. So I think that Turkey is also in a way allied against Saudi Arabia. Not openly, but, you know, if push comes to shove, they will go with Iran. And again, Iran and Turkey and Russia are involved in Syria. So I think that, you know, ultimately it all comes down to if some wise policies are drilled through the brain of the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, then things could improve. Otherwise, things would not improve.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
What, sorry?
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book after having read it, what would it be?
No, I think they would like to see, I mean, if you let me put it, I'm sorry, let's say that, you know, I am being very positive say, let's say that I have a power in Iran. If I would advise King bin Salman, King Salman, please, you already have advisory council in your country. We did not say you set it up. Start to give the advisory council more power. Issue a decree to say, yes, advisory committee can call the ministers, question them, they can, and then ask them to have some say in making the budget. they should have some control over their budget. You're making them say, okay, we advise the committee. You know, the Saudi Aramco, the biggest oil company in the world, does not publish annual financial accounts.
Yes.
Does not publish it. So they can say, okay, here's the advisory committee. It should be given access to the annual financial statement of this Saudi Aramco. So slowly, that advisory committee can be built up. See, as it is now, at the municipal level, they have elections, you know, and the elections happen intermittently in Saudi Arabia, in big cities, and their powers are to make sure that your vestige is cleared and the city street lights are on, and that's about all their power is. So you can give more power to the municipalities, you can give more power to the advisory, and then what you can say in the advisory committee itself, when there are 150 members, one third or one half will be elected directly, and in which men and women will have right to vote. So in slowly you can build up the advisory council into a properly elected assembly, legislative assembly. That can be done. So, but I don't think, you know, this is all what I say is a fancy idea. It's not going to happen.
I would like to thank you very much, Mr. Hero, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cutillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on New Books Network. Thank you, Mr. Hero.
Yes, very nice to talk to you at length. Thank you very much.